Reminders of our lab due dates. Homework. Oh, we got one coming right up. Chapter 5 due on Tuesday. Right? So we'll finish up Chapter 5 at the beginning of what we'll be talking about today. So you should have everything you need to finish the Chapter 5 assignments. Chapter 6 due the following Monday. Exam 2, 1 week from this Tuesday, November 4th, so chapters 4 through 6. So, however much of chapter 6 we get through, we'll be on that exam. So, don't put off preparing for that exam, right? You should be, of course you're doing the assignments and stuff as you're going along, but Holly reminded me of the practice exams that are on the webpage.
Oh, wait, that's on Tuesday, not today?
What's that?
So the exam's not today?
No, there's no exam today. It is a week from Tuesday. It's on November 4.
Okay, well, that makes me
so you have, you have at least 10 more days, okay, to work on it productively. So,
wow.
No wonder you had the practice exams out.
Okay? Yeah, I'm nervous.
But yeah, the second practice exam is chapters 2 and 3, or no, chapters 3 and 4, although the material is switched around a little bit, so some of the old chapter 3 material is in our chapter 4 now. So both the second and the third practice exam on the webpage, I think, will be very helpful for you. So, all right. So, there was one thing I was one. No, we'll deal with that later. So, anybody have any questions about any of our scheduling? Running.
WebAssign is really hard.
Yeah, WebAssign is a little bit challenging this time. WebAssign is a little bit challenging. Anybody have specific questions on the WebAssign?
I can
give you a little hint.
How do you know which one to pick? Like, if it will be question number mm-hmm. one. Okay, when the temperature increases, the volume decreases.
Yeah.
Whether it's a proportional, but how do you, with all those numbers that it gives you, how do you decide which ones to plug in the web?
Well, whenever you're changing anything, what we did, we could have taken any of those simple gas laws and make those changing relationships, so initial and final. Right, P1 V1 equals P2 V2, but we can derive any of those relationships using any variables that are changing by starting with the ideal gas law. Right, so PV equals NRT. You can have 1, 2, 3, or 4 of those different variables changing, and you can set up equations that will allow you to solve for that. All you have to do is get the variables that change to be on the same side of the equation. Okay. So the simplest one, I guess, you could do, if just P and V are changing and N, R, and T are constant, okay, you already have PV on one side of the equation, so P1, V1 equals P2, V2. Okay. If N, R, T are constant, N, R, T are not changing. So if you're changing pressure and volume, then it's just the things on that one side of the equation. Okay. So if...
What if everything is changing?
Yeah. What if P, V, and T are changing? The constants will be what?
N
and R. Okay. So we get those things that are changing on the same side of the equation. So what would that be? Yeah. P1, V1 over T1. I could say P1, V1 over T1 equals P2, V2 over T2. Okay? It's just like saying that PV over T is constant if N and R aren't changing. Okay? So you put the variables that are changing on one side, put the variables that are constant on the other side, and then you can set two equations equal to each other. Okay? So, and this is really nice because now you don't have to memorize any of those relationships. You can derive them right from the ideal gas law. Okay? So you can say PV equals constant, P over T equals a constant, P over N equals a constant, V over T, right? Any of those, you know, any of those things. You could, if you wanted to say, for instance, if you wanted to say N over P is a constant, you could do that however you like. But all you need to do is get the group the variables that are changing on one side, group all the constants together on the other side, and since it's constant, you can set two equations equal to each other. Okay, that help a little bit? Yeah. So, but yeah, if P, V, and T are changing, and N and R are constant, then P1, V1 over T1 equals P2, V2 over T2. Okay? You got a question? No, if I have you calculate the volume of a sphere, I'll give you its equation.
Yeah. One last thing.
Yeah. No. But yeah, it's 4/3 pi r cubed. Okay. Well, let's move on. But yeah, that was a good thing to talk about. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, with that, you can derive any relationship of any 2, 3, or 4 of those variables. Right? You could have PV over NT equaling just R, right? But then P1 V1 over N1 T1 equals P2 V2 over N2 T, yeah, N2 T2. So, all right. Well, it's time for us. We've done calculations involving figuring out pressures, figuring out volumes, moles, and stuff like that. Now that we've done that, let's go back and review and really try to learn one predominant theory that helps us explain all of those behaviors. Okay? And we've been doing this a little bit at a time as we've been introducing those simple gas laws. We've been thinking about why those are, but let's formalize it. So kinetic molecular theory is pretty much the simplest model for the behavior of gases. And it makes a couple of assumptions. Okay, makes, I'd say, pretty much 4 assumptions that are true in most cases. Our last slide will be what happens when these assumptions are no longer valid. Okay, but our first assumption will be that gases are made of particles, whether those be atoms or molecules, or just particles. They have nearly negligible volumes, but the gas sample itself is mostly empty space. Okay. We've discussed that quite a bit in this chapter. That's what makes gases compressible, because we're just pushing those molecules or atoms closer to each other. Okay? Empty space is just empty space, right? Another thing that we've referred to a little bit is that the average kinetic energy of those gas molecules is proportional to their absolute temperature. Okay? So, I can write that E sub K for kinetic energy is proportional to capital T, like that. Okay? So, kinetic energy is energy of motion, so that means temperature is just recording how much motion is occurring in these within these atoms and molecules. Okay? So, one other thing here, yeah, I can write that. Kinetic energy 1/2 mv². We're not going to use that as a calculation, but sometimes it's just nice to see how kinetic energy is calculated. So kinetic energy takes mass and velocity. Okay? Little v is velocity. So it takes mass and velocity into account. And I remember at the beginning of this chapter, somebody raised the question, well, how is it that large molecules and small molecules, how is it the size of the molecules doesn't matter when we're dealing with temperature? Well, it's because it's the kinetic energy itself that's proportional to temperature, and kinetic energy takes the mass into account. Okay? So if we have a more massive molecule, it will be moving slower. Okay? If we have a small molecule, it'll be moving faster, but they'll have the same kinetic energy through this relationship, okay, if it's the same temperature. Okay? So that's just stuff to keep in the back of our mind as we're figuring out how these different gas laws work. The particles fly in a straight line until they collide with another particle or the wall of the container. Okay? So if we had one gas molecule in a vacuum, it would fly in a perfectly straight line until it hit the wall. Okay? In a sample of gases, all of those gas molecules are flying until they collide with another gas molecule. And at one atmosphere, really those collisions are happening all the time. They're happening very quickly. So even though they're relatively far apart from each other, they're moving very fast, so they'll be colliding with each other fairly frequently. Okay? So, you know, it will only fly a tiny fraction of a second before it collides with another gas molecule. Okay? But those collisions are completely elastic. So that means that energy is exchanged. So as the kinetic, if you had, for instance, a stationary molecule, which you can't really have, but if you had a stationary molecule and another came flying up to it, all of that energy would be transferred into the stationary molecule. Okay? So, and we assume that transfer happens perfectly. Of course, it's in real life, it really doesn't, but this is a valid assumption to make for most samples of gases. So an elastic collision is just where all the energy is transferred, nothing is lost to heat, for instance. Okay. So through those assumptions, what we're going to do is go back to to the four named gas laws that we have encountered. So Boyle's law, who knows which two variables Boyle's law relates? Yeah, volume and pressure. Boyle's law is what you study in lab. Okay? So, and if I were to try to figure out Boyle's law without having memorized anything, I could take PV equals NRT. Okay? So, if I want to get those on opposite sides of a fraction, if I'm keeping everything else constant, then we say PV is constant, or the book likes to put all of these in terms of volume first. So volume will be proportional to what? 1 over P? Yep. Okay. So thinking of Boyle's law in terms of kinetic molecular theory, it's actually easiest if we imagine a decrease in volume. Okay, so imagine we tested Boyle's law in lab. You had that sealed syringe, and you were actually pulling it out. Right. So when you increase the volume, you decrease the pressure. Right. But let's think of a sealed container that we're compressing, okay? Because that'll make it a little easier for us to imagine how Boyle's law works. Let's say as volume decreases, what will happen to the pressure? Yep. Pressure will increase. Okay. And why? Why do you think pressure will increase according to kinetic molecular theory?
Because you're giving them less space.
Yeah. They have less space to fly around. And what causes pressure in terms of the molecules and the atoms? What is the cause of pressure?
Collisions.
Yeah, the collisions, really collisions against what?
The wall.
Yeah, collisions against the wall of the container. So as we make the container smaller, what happens? Yeah, more collisions per surface area, right? Let's just say more collisions right. So as we make the chamber smaller, those per the amount of wall space that we have, we've got more of those atoms beating against it. Okay? So this is the kind of thing we're doing. We are taking these gas laws and rationalizing them in terms of that kinetic molecular theory. So this is actually the way that science works. We're doing this in sort of the right order. They observe a certain gas law. That's why it's called a law, because you know you're just observing something. We haven't explained it yet. Then a theory is constructed that explains why those laws are the way they are. And there are several other experimental tests that can be used to confirm that and so on. Okay? So, who remembers what two things Charles's law compares. It's volume. All of these, pretty much all of these are volumes. Yeah, this is volume and temperature. Okay? So, regarding where they are in the ideal gas law, PV equals NRT, volume, let's use my same green color here, volume is proportional to what? Temperature, if the others are constant. Okay? Let's just say with the others constant. Okay? So, the way I'd like us to think about this is as we increase the temperature, okay, what did I say temperature is actually related to in gas molecules? Yeah, kinetic energy. As we raise the temperature, we raise the kinetic energy. Okay? They get more energy to them. Okay? If volume is changing, what does that say about the kind of container we're using? Yeah, it's expandable, it's flexible. Okay? So if these gas molecules have more kinetic energy to them, okay, the first thing they'll do is strike the walls more often. But if the container is flexible, what's the container going to do? Expand, right? They're striking the walls more often. The container will expand in response until the pressure is what it should be, right? If we're saying with the others constant, if we keep pressure constant, the container will have to expand to keep the same amount of collisions with the wall, okay? So let's say first, more collisions, then container expands. Okay? So you could think of it that way. Or if you're thinking of keeping pressure constant the whole time, the only way for that pressure to remain constant is for the container to expand, for the balloon to get larger, or if you're doing this in the piston, for the top of the piston to be moving upwards. Okay?
Which is why hot pans explode in
your car. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. If you're raising the temperature, well, the first thing that'll happen is the pressure increases because a pop can usually isn't flexible. Okay? So that would be like, for instance, a pressure cooker. Okay? You would be raising a temperature. First, you're raising the pressure just because there's more collisions. But once you raise that pressure enough, then the can or the container can't hold on to it anymore. So Charles's law really is relating to flexible containers. So this would be, for instance, those balloons that were shrinking in the liquid nitrogen. Right? And when I took it out of the liquid nitrogen, they warmed up to room temperature and expanded again. Okay? So it's similar. It's a container that's semi-flexible, like a Ziploc bag or something like that, which is flexible to a certain point, would undergo Charles's law first. As temperature increases, its volume would increase. But then, if volume becomes fixed, then what will increase? Yeah, pressure. It'll start building up pressure until it breaks. Right.
And then it becomes...
Boyle's law is pressure and volume. There's another law for temperature and pressure that we haven't named here. Okay? So, but it'll look just like Charles's law. So volume, so pressure and temperature are proportional. Okay? All right. Anybody have questions so far? What does Avogadro's law relate volume to?
Yes.
Yeah, N. Okay? So this one should be pretty easy to explain from our kinetic molecular theory, right? As we increase the number of moles, if I pump in some extra gas in there, okay, first of all, what would happen if we couldn't change volume? Pressure would increase, okay? But if we can change the volume, if we're pumping gas into a balloon, what happens? Yeah, the volume increases. Okay? Maybe it could be in response to the extra collisions on the interior walls of the container, or it could just be in order to keep the pressure the same as it was before. Right? So let's just write that. Increasing moles of gas, increasing volume, right, to accommodate they spell accommodate. One M? M? Two M's? No spell checking when I'm writing it. To accommodate extra collisions. Okay. ACCOMI or O? Accommode. Yeah, I thought this didn't quite look right. But spell check really ruins you, doesn't it? Alright. Okay. So, Dalton's law. Dalton's law is not just one of these simple gas laws. It's a relationship between two things. Dalton's law deals with what? Partial pressures and mixtures of gases, right? Let's just write that. Total pressure equals the sum of all the partial pressures. PA plus PB, PC, and so on. Okay? So, what part of the kinetic molecular theory explains to us that if I have a partial pressure of one gas and a partial pressure of another gas, those will add together to make the total pressure? Anything? Let me give you another little statement that relates to Dalton's law. I'll tell you that gases act independently. Okay. That's really still part of Dalton's law, so here I'll make it green. Gases act independently. There you go. What part of kinetic molecular theory allows us to say that one gas molecule will act pretty much independently of another gas molecule? Anything? Give you a hint. Liquids are not completely independent. There's weird things that happen when you mix liquids together because the molecules are all right up next to each other. They're pulling against each other and so on. So the first one has a good impact on this. Since they're nearly negligible volumes of particles themselves, they're mostly empty space. Okay? And when they do collide, what do we assume about the behavior of gases? What happens when they do collide? Yeah, they're elastic collisions. So nothing weird happens. They'll just transfer energy straight to the other one, okay? But otherwise act independently of each other, right? So gases act independently. That's because small particle size. Just say it like that. If they spend most of their time just as individual particles flying around, they're going to act like individual particles flying around, regardless of the other particles that they happen to be sharing the container with. Okay? So, is that making sense so far? So, what you may be asked to do would be, for instance, in a multiple choice question, I could say, which simple gas law is this a kinetic molecular theory explanation of? Okay? If I said, for instance, as volume decreases, there are more collisions with the wall area, which gas law is this? Okay. Yeah, so I could say which of the following is an explanation of volume being proportional to temperature and give you a list of explanations. Okay? I could make it short answer where I would say, given Charles's law or given volume proportional to temperature, what is a six words or less explanation of that according to kinetic molecular theory? Okay? So no essay questions, no big dissertations that you have to write, but you should be familiar with these explanations, and that will actually help you, though, with your with understanding relationships of gases. If you have theoretical if you have a theoretical basis to these things, which you should have in a class like this, then that'll help you. You'll see, you know, you'll be able to check your answers a little more easily, right? Knowing that if volume is increasing, the temperature must have increased because of thinking of how these things are colliding and so on. Okay? So have some familiarity with that, enough to at least rationalize the things that we've put up here. Okay? Questions? So let's do just a little more work with how temperature and velocity of these gases are related. So knowing what we know about kinetic molecular theory, we can actually calculate the average molecular velocity. Okay? So this does not mean that every gas molecule at a certain temperature will have the same velocity. There will be many that are going faster, many that are going slower. There will be many that have higher kinetic energy and lower kinetic energy. And we can only talk about averages when we're dealing with the sample of a gas. So we refer to it as RMS, root mean square average, which is just a type of average. It's just the square root of the sum of the squares, for instance. It's just one way of calculating an average. Okay? So what this is, let me write the sheet here. Here's the equation, and it is U. I don't know why it's a lowercase u instead of a v. That's just how molecular velocities are shown. So here's the equation. U RMS square root of this whole fraction, 3RT over molar mass. Okay? What is R? What have we used R before?
0.82.
Yeah. It's a certain numerical value. It's a constant. Let's just call it the gas constant. And we've been calling it gas constant. Actually, R is much more than that. Okay? R is actually the constant that's used when dealing with anything involving energy and motion or something like that of atoms and molecules, it turns out. Okay? So R is going to keep showing up over and over again throughout this course in things unrelated to gases, because it's really the constant that gets us into, you know, that helps us do calculations with energies, for instance. Okay? So in second semester, R is going to show up in one really surprising place at the end of the semester. That's going to be pretty interesting. So R is a gas constant. T is temperature in what unit, do you suppose? Yeah. Temperature in Kelvin. Okay. Now, look at molar mass on the bottom of that fraction. Okay. Why do you suppose molar mass is in this relationship? What would molar mass have anything to do with the velocity of a molecule? Yeah. Remember, kinetic energy had mass in it. So a more massive molecule, right, if we have a very massive molecule, do you suppose it'll move fast or slow? Yeah, it'll move relatively slow, and that corresponds with molar mass being on the bottom of this fraction. As molar mass increases, the velocity of those molecules will decrease. Okay? It's a very important relationship. Let's just do increase in molar mass, decrease in velocity. Okay? So let's do one of these problems. Okay? I want to know what is the root mean square velocity of nitrogen molecules at 298 Kelvin. Okay? But before we go plugging away in here, before we just go punching in numbers, I put something in bold and underlined here. You must be very careful of units in these calculations. Okay? With PV equals NRT, you sort of got by if you said, okay, atmospheres, Kelvins, liters. You know, if you just kind of double-check to make sure familiar units were around, you were okay. Okay? With this, you have to absolutely write the units in. You have to absolutely make sure you're using the correct value of R. Okay? So I have given you here R, not the familiar R, not the 0.08206, right? I have 8.314. It's the same R, but it's in different units. Okay? Just like the same length could be measured in inches or centimeters or meters or something like that, the same R is given in these different units. And this is in SI units. Okay? So instead of anything other than the standard system, this is R with kilograms meter squared per second squared Kelvin mole. Now, we've got all these kinds of digits, all these units in here. We have to be really careful with watching out how they cancel each other out. So that's our R. Okay, our T, what's the T we're using? 298 Kelvin for this problem. Okay, so we've got R and T, molar mass. When I say nitrogen molecules, what am I referring to?
N2.
I'm referring to N2. Yeah. Yeah. And we try to be pretty careful about that nomenclature, but I could have even just said nitrogen, because a pure sample of a diatomic element has diatomic molecules in it. Okay? Nitrogen atoms are not stable alone. So molar mass, what, 28.02? But, hold on here, what are the units of that molar mass?
Grams.
Grams what?
Grams
per mole. Yeah, those grams aren't going to be okay because look at our R. R has kilograms. Okay? This molar mass.
0.02802.
Yep. You do that however you like to, but 0.02802 kilograms per mole. Okay? So, be extra careful of this. If we use the regular R, that has liters atmospheres kelvins per moles. We have nowhere for atmospheres to go in this calculation. We have nowhere for liters to go. We have a molar mass and a temperature. Okay? And what we want to get out is a velocity. So, why don't you plug this in? Square root bracket. So, probably the best way to do this would be to just start with your multiplying, then divide, and then take the square root of that answer. Right. The square root comes from, it's just an artifact of calculating a root mean square average. So a square root is a, RMS is a square root of sums of squares. So just there's, and I think the book derives it, we're not too worried about that. So, anybody get an answer? Yeah, I got 515 as my number. Let's deal with. Yeah, let's take a look at these units. Yeah. Yeah. Here, take a look. Kilograms. Does kilograms cancel? Yep, kilograms in R, kilograms in the bottom of the fraction. Okay. Anything cancel with these meters squared? Nope. Second squared, any canceling? Nope. Moles? Yes, moles cancel. Kelvin? Yep. Okay. So our units inside of this square root are meters squared per second squared. Okay. But then, what does the square root do to them? Yeah. Square root of meter squared over second squared. See how that works?
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty neat, right? 515 meters per second. Okay? So, inside of there, if we cancel things correctly, we have meters squared per second squared, but we've taken the whole square root of the whole thing. Okay? So, any kind of math that happens to those numbers has to also happen with the units themselves.
Yeah.
That's the entire concept of unit analysis in calculations. So you should be prepared to... and doing the unit analysis with something like this is just sort of an extra added check to make sure you haven't substituted something in wrong or you haven't forgotten to convert a unit that you need to. Okay. So... 515 meters per second, that means if I had a single nitrogen atom at room temperature in a vacuum and I let it go, it would go 515 meters in 1 second. Okay? Now, of course, in air is mostly nitrogen. The air molecules do not go 515 straight meters in a second. They go 515 crooked meters because of all of their collisions. Right? If they're undergoing hundreds or thousands of collisions per second, it will travel a total of 515 meters, but because it's doing all those collisions in 1 second, it may only make it from here to here. Only make it a couple of linear feet, for instance, from as the bird flies. So, but that gives you an idea as to what happens when a gas is diffusing. Okay? The book uses the example of the perfume counter at a department store. Now, if somebody spilled a bottle, it would take a certain amount of time for that to reach you over at the other side of the store as you're smelling it. It would happen very quickly if there were no air molecules in the way, but because of all those collisions, it'll take a much longer time for that to happen. So this is total meters per second, not point A to point B necessarily. Okay? So... you'll be given this equation on the exam. Okay? You'll be given U RMS equals square root 3RT over molar mass. All of the values of R are given on that conversion sheet. Sure they are. Lower right. There they are. What do you see? Do you see 8.314? Joules. So 8.314. What was that one? Joules? Huh? 8.314 joules per mole Kelvin. A joule is a kilogram meter squared per second squared. We're going to talk about that in the next chapter. See how that works? Kilogram meter squared per second squared. I'll have that for you in chapter 6. Okay? So... take a look at how that works. Right? Kilogram meter squared are on the top of that fraction, second squared are on the bottom of that fraction. Okay? So, on an exam, I will probably have this definition of joule for you, though.
It's on there.
Yeah. Oh, joule. Yeah, the definition of joules is on the conversion sheet. Yeah. There you go. So... the requisite information is on the sheet, I guess. So, all right. Related to this discussion of velocity is, like I mentioned, with breaking the bottle of perfume, thinking about how long that takes to get from one room to the next. Okay? That is essentially the same conversation as if you have this container, like we have in the picture here, filled with gas on one side. It's got a partition in the middle of it. So, gas on one side, vacuum on the other side, and a little pinhole that was poked in that partition. Okay? Effusion, E-F-F-U-S-I-O-N, effusion, is the escape of gas through that pinhole into a vacuum. Okay? Diffusion, with a D, is a gas spreading in a container or mixing with other gases. Okay? So, breaking the perfume bottle is diffusion, because those smelly molecules will take a while to diffuse throughout the rest of the air. Okay? But really, it's the same conversation. It's thinking about how long it's taking for a gas molecule to maneuver its way from one place to another. Okay? So these two things are both very closely related to the molar mass of that particular gas molecule. Okay? We won't be calculating any actual values for diffusion rate or diffusion rate of a single gas, okay, because there are so many variables, you know, what all it's bumping into, the size of the pinhole, how much of it there is, and so on. But we can calculate relative rates, okay, comparing one gas versus another gas. So how do you think molar mass of this will work out? If we have a very heavy molecule, will it diffuse and diffuse very slowly or very quickly?
Slowly.
Yeah, a heavy molecule will go much more slowly, just really in terms of velocity, like we saw on the last page. Okay? So this is really just an application of that velocity. So here's the equation that I'll let you use for diffusion and diffusion rate. If I say, don't have the right sheet here. Oh, that's all right. I know how to do this. If I have, let's just say, rate for substance A over rate for substance B. Okay. So we can say is something like nitrogen goes 3 times faster than hydrogen, or methane goes 4 times faster than hydrogen, or something like that. So that would be rate A over rate B, where A is one substance and B is another substance.
So it would be like.
We're just figuring out that kind of fraction. So all that is, since it's inversely proportional to those molar masses, we have one big square root, molar mass of B over molar mass of A. Okay? So rate A over rate B is the square root of molar mass B over molar mass A. That's because of that inverse relationship. Because the bigger it is, the slower it goes. So what was on top for our rates relationship is on the bottom inside of that square root there. Okay. So if you switch those around, you'll be going the wrong direction. So here's my little question here. Which balloon would shrink faster, one filled with helium or one filled with nitrogen, and by what ratio? What on earth does a shrinking balloon have anything to do with what I'm talking about on this page? If I fill up a balloon, we're close. Let me put it to you this way: if you fill a regular latex balloon with helium, okay, and you tie it up and you put it on a string, will it stay like that forever?
No,
it'll stay like that for a couple of days. Yeah, the helium escapes. Where does the helium escape through?
Little
tiny holes in the balloon. Latex is not solid. Okay? It's a polymer made of several strands, and there are tiny little pinholes in the middle of those strands that gas molecules can escape from. So it's not like someone poked a hole in it and it's all escaping through one point. It's escaping through the whole balloon. Okay? Tiny little microscopic holes in the balloon allow the gas to escape. Okay? Now, which one will shrink faster? What do you think? One filled with helium or nitrogen? Yeah. The helium one will shrink much faster. Why?
Because nitrogen's molecule.
Yeah, nitrogen's big, helium's small. Okay? Yeah. So let's figure out the ratio. Okay? I want to know how much faster. So if I want a positive ratio, I'm going to need to have the rate of helium over rate of N2. Okay. So inside of that fraction, what number are you going to put on top inside of that square root? What should you put on top of that fraction? Yeah. So to put 28.02 grams per mole. On the bottom of that fraction, what do you put?
Wait a minute. Isn't that the inverse of the rate of helium in the top?
Uh-huh.
So
take a look at our equation.
Oh, duh. Okay.
Right. They get swapped around because it's an inverse relationship.
Oh, yeah.
Right? What molar mass on the bottom? What's molar mass of helium?
4.003.
So divide them, then take the square root. Helium is not diatomic. Hydrogen is. Yeah, hydrogen is. Helium is a noble gas, so it's stable as lone atoms.
2.65.
You can do 4 sig figs. Why not?
No, that would be 2.64.
Say that again.
2.64.
So it gets 2.646? Yep. Okay. So what does that answer mean? What does 2.646 mean? Yeah, it's a ratio. If you were to put 2.646 in a complete sentence, what would you say?
It would be helium's 2.646 times faster.
Yep, yep. The helium balloon will shrink 2.646 times faster.
Right.
I like those kind of calculations.
Yeah. Those aren't too bad. Okay.
So, on this final exam, like, let's say we were given, like, would they ever give us, like, a time how long it would take for one gas to escape and then predict how long it would take the other gas to escape?
Yeah. If, well, and it's not a specific thing. It could be a time it takes for the balloon to shrink by half, for instance. Or a time it takes to completely deflate the balloon, for instance, or something like that. If it took the nitrogen balloon 10 seconds, it would take the helium balloon, how many?
6 seconds.
Yeah, if it took helium. What did I say?
If it took nitrogen, then
you'd have to divide. You know, if it took helium 10 seconds, it would take nitrogen 26.4 seconds. Okay. So something like that is probably fair. You would just have to multiply that ratio or divide that ratio. Okay. All right. Other questions?
All right. Yeah. No, something like that is reasonable. I don't anticipate myself asking something like that. If I were to ask you a question like that, I would say, how many more times faster, or what is the ratio, or something like that. But it's not outside of the realm of possibility that. All right. Our last bit of this chapter deals with the situations where those assumptions we made for kinetic molecular theory are no longer valid. Okay? So, like I say here, first, the ideal gas law is accurate when the volume of gas particles is small compared to the space between them. Okay? That was a whole central principle of kinetic molecular theory, that the particles are acting independently of each other. Okay? And related to that, the attractive forces between gas molecules are not significant. Okay? Now, in liquids or solids, there are very significant attractive forces. They pull each other together. That's what keeps liquids as liquids and prevents all the molecules from just flying away. Okay? Same thing with solids. There are those forces that pull one molecule to another. Okay? But in order for the ideal gas law to be accurate, those must not be significant. Okay? So I say that these assumptions are valid around standard temperature and pressure. Okay? So 0 degrees C, right? So 273 Kelvin, 1 atmosphere, that's sort of the center point around which our theory is designed. Okay? If we go too much in either direction from standard temperature and pressure, we start to have problems. Okay? So these assumptions are not valid, for instance, when the pressure is much higher than 1 atmosphere. Okay? And
I'm not going to give you specifics here, but we can do ideal gas law to reasonable significant, you know, to reasonable precision, you know, for any kind of pressure that we would encounter in a laboratory. Okay. So, but when you get huge pressures, when you start using reinforced containers made of, you know, 3-inch thick stainless steel with big bolts on them, and you start building up huge pressures like that, and you know, essentially making a bomb, that kind of stuff. The ideal gas law pretty much breaks down. So let's talk about high pressures. Let's talk about 50 atmospheres, 200 atmospheres, okay? Hugely higher pressures. If that's the case, several hundred atmospheres, the molecules themselves take up a significant amount of the sample's volume. Okay? If there's a very high pressure, what does that mean? A lot of molecules hitting the sides of the containers. Okay? Where one atmosphere, we'd have collisions here and there, but 200-300 times that, we'd have 200-300 times as many of those collisions. So all of those molecules will be much, you know, much tighter quarters around each other. Okay? So ideal gas law predicts the molecules will have no volume. Okay? So what do you think? I'm going to ask you a little prediction here. If we have a very high temperature, the ideal gas law predicts molecules have no volume. Okay? But if we're doing this for real, the actual volume will be higher than what we predicted or lower than what we predicted?
Higher.
Yeah. The actual volume will be quite a bit higher than the prediction. Okay? Here. Does that make sense? Right. These actual molecules are taking up a significant amount of space. Okay. Ideal gas law will be short on our volume because those actual molecules are taking up space. So to correct for this, we have to change volume. I'm going to say volume becomes V minus NV, okay? If our prediction was low, okay, if our actual volume was higher than the prediction, we're going to have to do V minus NV to get us back into what the ideal gas law can figure us out. Okay? So getting us back into, you know, ideal land, right, where everything acts perfectly, we need to take away that volume of all those extra molecules. Okay. That gets us back into the equation where everything is working as usual. Okay. So if our actual volume is higher, go ahead. What is B? I haven't told you what B is. B is a constant for that particular substance. Okay. And what do you suppose B has to do with? What is N, first of all?
Moles.
Yeah, and it's number of moles, so it's number. It's how many there are. But what do you suppose B has something?
Yeah.
It's related to the volume of the molecules themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's not molar mass, okay, because a molecule with one molar mass could take up a different amount of volume as another, depending on what its structure is. Okay. So B is a constant. You would just go look it up from a table, for instance, if you ever needed it. Okay. So let's just say B is a constant for molecular volume. Okay. So does that make sense? We're on the same page so far? Okay. We've got to take away that volume of atoms in order to get us back to where ideal gas law is. Okay. Now, when the temperature is much lower, so I raised pressure many atmospheres. When the temperature is much lower than room temperature, when we start chilling things in liquid nitrogen, for instance, okay, when we start doing cryogenics where we're getting things very, very cold, with low temperatures, the molecules begin to stick together more. Why do you suppose that is? When I lower the temperature, what am I actually lowering? I'm lowering their kinetic energy, and by relationship, their speed is slower, their velocity is slower, and when they're moving slower, they're more able to start pulling towards each other. Okay?
we're going to do this relationship next semester quite a bit, but things that are traveling very fast, even if they sort of get near each other, they'd be going too fast to have much of a attraction. But if they're going slower, they got more time to start pulling together. Okay? If that's the case, if they start to stick together more, they will be less available to be flying around and hitting the edges of the container. Right? If you have these little billiard balls all shooting around on the surface of the pool table, right, they'll be hitting the sides quite a bit. But if you have Velcro balls that stick together much more, they'll be rolling around, but they'll stick together more and they will hit the walls much less. Okay? So the actual pressure will be what, higher than what we predict or lower? Yeah. Actual pressure will be lower than prediction. Green. Okay. Ideal gas law predicts that they won't be sticking at all. They'll just be flying around and hitting walls, but they are actually sticking together. So, to correct for this, we have to change the P term. P becomes something a little more complicated. P plus N squared A over V squared. Okay? So, what we have to do, we have to add in, because our prediction, our actual pressure will be lower than what we predicted. Okay? We're going to have to add back in those collisions that were taken away when they were stuck together. Okay? So, A, what do you suppose A is related to? Yeah, it's a constant just like B was. Area? Yeah, there you go. A is a constant for, I'll call them intermolecular forces. Yeah. Yep, absolutely. You can go into a reference book and look up A and B constants. They're called van der Waals constants for many gases, right? For most of them. Okay? So that means the van der Waals equation, and if you've heard of van der Waals forces, those are one type of forces that can pull molecules together. Van der Waals came up with that work alongside his work with fixing the ideal gas law for these extremes. So the van der Waals equation just makes these substitutions into ideal gas law. So PV equals NRT instead becomes those substitutions. So P squared P plus N squared A over V squared. That was what P was. Volume becomes what? What did I say? Yep. And then equals NRT. Okay? I can tell you right now on the exam, I will not have you solving the van der Waals equation. Too bad, right? Okay? On the exam, however, I may present the van der Waals equation to you and, for instance, ask you what the purpose is of changing P into P plus N squared A over V squared. Or what the purpose is of changing V into V minus NV. Okay? Your answers do not have to be complicated. Okay? Your answer for volume is just that at high pressures, the volume of molecules becomes more significant. That's it. Okay? Your answer for this is that at low temperatures, the intermolecular forces or the attractive forces become more significant. Okay? That's really it. So, it wouldn't hurt to understand why actual volume would be higher than predicted, why actual pressure would be lower than predicted. Okay? But you do not have to memorize the van der Waals equation. I really won't have you substituting into it because that's just too long of a calculation for our experiment. Okay? But having a little bit of theoretical basis to understanding that will get us very far. Okay? Understanding these kind of things here will help us quite a bit in understanding how
intermolecular forces work later on, and so on. So understanding these limitations helps us understand the circumstances in which ideal gas law is valid. Okay? So that's about it. You guys, questions there? So I've done calculations like this before for some classes sometimes. If you get to high pressures or low temperatures, the differences can be very striking. Okay? One difference that we did one CO2 at 100 atmospheres or something like that, and the calculated pressure was 40 liters versus 20 liters or something like that. So it makes huge differences at these larger volumes. But the van der Waals equation can be very effective at taking almost any extreme into account. Now, once you start condensing a gas into a liquid, if you gave it so much pressure that there's actually no space between the molecules, then you have a liquid, don't you? Right? You have molecules that are moving fast but are right up next to each other. Yeah, you got liquid oxygen. The liquid nitrogen I was using on Tuesday, for instance, has been condensed like that. Once condensation starts, then we can't do anything with gasoline. Okay? So, let's move on then. That was the end of chapter 5. Let's just get a good start to chapter 6. We got plenty of time. And I think, anyway, that chapter 5 a bit was where things started to get a little interesting. You got a good amount of new stuff. Chapter 6, definitely things get much more interesting. I'll put it that way. Our chapters 1 through 4 were things that you, to at least some level, you had heard something about before, right? Even though we're adding additional things in along the way. Okay? But chapter 6 is really going to be very powerful for us because we will be able to take not just reactants and products into account, but possibly heat into account. Right? If something gets warmer or something gets colder, we're going to use this same sort of stuff in the second semester to actually predict whether a reaction will happen or not. Okay? When you combine two things together, sometimes two things will react, sometimes two other things will not react. Okay? We're going to take some of this stuff and next semester be able to answer questions like that. But to start out with, we have to be dealing with energy and heat for the most part. So that's what thermal chemistry is, study of the relationships between chemical reactions, chemical substances, you know, compounds, molecules, and energy. Okay? So we had defined energy just very briefly in the beginning of this class, and this definition doesn't really do energy justice. It's the standard physics definition, the capacity to do work. Okay? If you have a lot of energy in you, you are able to move a lot of boxes around, you know, that kind of stuff. If you have very little energy, you might want to go pick one up, but then say, oh, forget it, let's go take a nap or something. But the same thing works with chemistry. Something with high energy has a large capacity to do work, to make changes, to push things, to do stuff like that, but low energy being the opposite. And work, in terms of physics anyway, is just the result of a force acting over a certain distance. Work is just one way to transfer energy. Okay? If you are doing work, if you're moving big boxes, you are transferring your stored energy into the friction and the lifting of those boxes. Right? So work is just one way of transferring energy. The book uses all kinds of pictures and comparisons with billiard balls. You know, for instance, if a rolling ball has a certain amount of kinetic energy, when it strikes a stationary ball, it will transfer its energy to that other ball and get it rolling again. But in doing so, it has done work on that other ball. Okay? It has supplied a force to that ball, which allows it to travel over a certain distance. Okay. So work is just one way to get energy from one place to another place. Okay? Now, let's just review. Types of energy, usually broken most simply into kinetic and potential energy, okay? Where kinetic is how things are moving, potential energy is how something will be able to do something later on, right? So potential energy here we say is energy of position or composition. And the example I always like to use is that a very expensive breakable vase teetering on the edge of the top of a bookshelf has a large amount of potential energy to it, because if there were a little gust of wind or something, it would fall down and break into a million pieces. Okay? So potential energy is just the potential to do something like that. Now, specific to chemistry, right, specific to how we do things, our major form of kinetic energy is thermal energy. Okay? And it actually is kinetic energy. We saw that just before, that temperature is proportional to the kinetic energy of those molecules. Right? So it really is kinetic energy because it's how those molecules are moving. But thermal energy is just energy associated with a certain temperature. And the transfer of thermal energy is what we call heat. Okay? Heat is not a type of energy. Okay? Heat is the transfer of energy. So just like work was the transfer of energy from, you know, from my muscles to a box or something like that, heat is the transfer of energy from a hot object to a cold object. Okay? So energy is the fuel itself, okay? But either heat or work are the ways that fuel is transferred. Okay? The form of potential energy that we discuss in here, we call it chemical energy. It's just the energy associated with the composition of chemical compounds. Okay? A container of gasoline has a large amount of potential energy to it, because if I drop a match into there, it'll start on fire and it'll burn, and we could heat water with that and turn a propeller or something with that, for instance. So, yeah, the energy associated with the composition of chemical compounds. And that's just a fancy way of saying just the energy that's locked up inside of compounds. So the octane in gasoline, in its atoms and its bonds, has a large amount of energy that can be released when it's burned. Okay? So, and that's one form of potential energy, because it's energy that's just stored away, ready to be transferred at some other point. Okay? Yeah, absolutely. An atomic bomb, for instance, a hydrogen bomb, has a tremendous, you know, everything around us has a tremendous amount of potential energy in the nucleus, okay? And an atomic bomb is what can release that energy from the nucleus. But a standard explosive just has a large amount of chemical energy, just the same way gasoline does, just in its regular chemical bonds that is free to be released once the reaction starts. Okay? So those are just basic concepts. It's this is not designed to be anything too tremendously alien. It should be things that we'll just keep in our minds as we're going along here. Okay? So the couple of other things that will prerequisites, I guess, that we need before we get much further here. Law of conservation of energy will come back to us real soon again. The energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can only be transferred. So we're always interested in transfer of energy, whether it be through work or through heat. Okay? Energy, we can't make new energy. We can't get rid of energy. It's always going from point A to point B. Okay? Always. And the direction of that transfer will be very important to us later on. Okay? The amount of energy that's transferred will be important to us, okay? But it goes from one place to another, or within the same object, we can make one form of energy into another form of energy. Okay? So we can convert kinetic energy into electrical energy, for instance, by turning a crank on a generator, for instance. And we can do the opposite. We can convert electrical energy into kinetic energy with a motor. Okay? We can convert chemical energy into kinetic energy when you push on the gas pedal in your car. Right? We've got a chemical reaction that's happening. The combustion of the gasoline is pushing the cylinders that turns the wheels in your car. So all of those, but in every case, we've not created any energy. We've not lost any energy. We've gone from one place to another. It turns out energy really can never perfectly transfer from one place to another. Some is always dissipated in the form of heat, whether we want it to or not. Okay, we'll talk about that in just a second. Okay. Here are a couple of units of energy. The joule is the unit which we will be using almost exclusively in this class. That is the SI unit of energy. I gave you its definition before. 1 kilogram meter squared per second squared. Where on earth do kilograms and meters and seconds, what does that have to do with energy? What do you think? Anybody taken any physics? Yeah, the best way to think about it, I think, you know, energy is the capacity to do work, right? Mm-hmm. So work is something like, pushing a big crate along the ground or something like that. So a joule is the amount of energy to, yeah. So it's required to accelerate 1 kilogram through, 1 meter squared, second squared, right? So it's a mass and acceleration and so on. So so it comes from that. It comes from the simple idea of pushing a big crate, a certain distance or something like that. But it's really more general than that. It can be used for any of the forms of energy that we've talked about. Okay. So other common units, the calorie, 4.184 joules in 1 calorie. So the calorie comes from a really neat kind of definition. It is the energy required to heat 1 gram of water by 1 degree Celsius. Okay? So if I have a gram of water, if I have a little milliliter of water, okay, a little sugar cube worth of water, and I want to take it from 25 to 26 degrees, that will require 1 calorie of heat. Okay? So it's really very, the joule and the calorie really are very small units of heat. Okay? If we're thinking of, things that heat like a stove or a furnace or a hairdryer, that's a much greater amount of energy than these small units are. Okay? So the calorie with a capital C is the same as 1 kilocalorie with a small c. Okay? So if I group 1,000 of those little calories together, I get a big calorie. Okay?
Is that pretty much what we think of?
Yes, and that's what we think of commonly as a calorie. So if you see calories listed on a food label, that's the amount of heat required to, or the amount of heat given off by combusting that cupcake or whatever. Okay? So that is really kilocalories in the way that we think of them, but if you ever see calorie on a food label, whether or not the C is capitalized, it's really referring to kilocalories. Okay? Finally, kilowatt hour. Very common. It's sort of a strange way of considering energy, because watt is a rate of energy usage times a certain number of hours that you've used that energy. So it's a sort of backwards like that, but it's how power companies think of energy. It's how Xcel Energy thinks of electricity. So a kilowatt hour is a very large unit of energy, so 3.6 times 10 to the 6 joules. Okay. So joules are really a very small unit. Kilowatt hours, that's what you're charged for electricity in your home. That's what they read off on your meter at your home every month. Okay. So that's where we'll stop. We'll start getting much more into energy and things like that. Take another cupcake if you want. There are 13 of them left. Please take one. And I've already had mine, so. Yeah, take two.